The best variety on your radio, 88.3 Southern FM.
Based on the pitch from the phone, burn time was 21.02 seconds, only differing 1 second off of the pre-burn predictions.
Copy that?
Welcome to Jupiter.
And coming up right now is the Space Show. Our theme music, which is Vangelis, Motion of Stars. Welcome to the Space Show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And guess what? Yes, from our teaser, you'll know what's on the show tonight. Yes, the Juno spacecraft has arrived in Jovian orbit. And we have Tanya Hill of the Melbourne Planetarium to explain why so much fuss is being made about this mission, Juno. And please keep your diary handy, because we have several entries for it. But first up, we're going to have Space Show News. Jim Green is the Associate Administrator of Planetary Sciences at NASA headquarters. And yes, he had this announcement to make on Tuesday afternoon, our time here in Melbourne. And here's what he had to say.
As many know, we've announced after an extensive peer review proposals that came in for 9 missions in planetary science that have completed their prime mission. The top recommendation is all these missions are returning fabulous data, and they need to continue to do so. In the case for Dawn, an option was presented to us to go to a separate location, another asteroid. And it comes at a time where Dawn would have to leave Ceres within the next couple weeks. The senior review took that into consideration, plus where Dawn was in completing the Ceres science and projecting forward with additional science that it could do while it remained at Ceres. And it was judged by the peer review science team that remaining at Ceres provided us the best science versus going to Adiona, which was an additional asteroid. So we accepted that recommendation and told all the teams that they have been extended. And that includes New Horizons flying out into the Kuiper Belt and flying by another Kuiper Belt object.
Well, there we go. Now, the alternative, if you don't extend the missions that are still operating but which have gone beyond their design life, is that if you don't fund a continuation, then guess what? They just simply flick the switch and switch it off, even though it could be doing good stuff. But no, NASA wouldn't do that, not on these missions. So there we go. They have extended the mission. Coming up, all about Juno.
Interesting stories, great songs and unusual voices here on Southern FM. Stories, songs and people's voices with Anton and Lisa every Wednesday between 11 and 1 p.m. Doesn't get any better than just
right now. This is the Space Show on Southern FM, and we're looking at Juno, which arrived in orbit around the planet Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system, yesterday. What an exciting time it was. Well, Richard Cook is the acting director of solar system exploration at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and he had this to say about what happened what would have happened had something gone wrong. As it turned out, it didn't go wrong. But anyway, here's Richard Cook with his comment about what Juno would have done had the radiation in particular done something bad to it.
Joining us now is Richard Cook. He is JPL's Acting Director of Solar System Exploration. And as we mentioned earlier in the news conferences, big concern is the radiation, dust, particles. All these things could be fatal for the spacecraft. This sounds like an extremely risky endeavor here.
That's right. I mean, Jupiter is the king of the planets, and it's certainly the most dangerous environment that we will send a spacecraft into. It has very high radiation, strong magnetic field, and so the spacecraft is really now entering the phase or the part of its voyage that we worry about the most.
As I understand, I mean, the team has prepared as much as it possibly can, but the thing that they can't anticipate is whatever Jupiter throws at them.
That's right. Although there are some things we have done in terms of the design of the spacecraft. In particular, because it's so far away, we really can't joystick it. We can't control it, you know, directly. We have to basically program it ahead of time to tell it what to do. And so a lot of what you're hearing is the spacecraft essentially doing exactly what we told it. That's a good thing. In addition to that, though, we provide protection in software so that if something goes wrong and the spacecraft, for example, the computer resets because it gets hit by a piece of radiation, it will restart the sequence of events. And so once the burn starts, actually all of the activities that it's doing now, if for some reason it gets interrupted, it will retry. It will keep retrying that until it finishes it.
And how would that affect things if that should occur today, if it gets hit by radiation or a dust particle and it decides to stop down? It'll just restart?
It will. It'll take a little time. Depends on what happens exactly, but usually the software restarts just like on your home computer. When something goes wrong, you start it up again, and it takes a little while to get going again.
So it's a reboot.
That's right. And then it figures out where it is and starts up again after a little bit of time. And so it may delay things, but it'll still occur in time to get us in orbit around Jupiter.
And so much of what we're doing tonight is keeping an eye on the timeline and seeing that things occur at a particular time. If there is a reboot, what would happen in terms of our timeline?
Depending on which scenario it is, it could be anywhere from just a few seconds to more like 10 minutes where it would, by the time it comes back up, once it's firing the engines, if it is interrupted at that point, it basically waits for about 8.5 minutes and then it starts up again and tries to continue burning the main engine.
So if we see a change in timing, the team's not worried?
No. I mean, it's as I said, we are worried about this particular phase of the mission, and so we build in all these protections that allow us to recover from problems.
All right. So it looks like so far
it's going great. Very excited about what we're seeing.
All right. Thank you, Richard Cook.
You're welcome.
And this is live coverage of Juno's arrival at Jupiter on NASA TV and the web. Tonight is what they call a critical event because it's a do or die moment. If the spacecraft is not safely placed into orbit around Jupiter, the mission is lost.
The Juno spacecraft came into Jupiter over the North Pole. It dived down south, making its closest point very near the equator, and then out over the South Pole and out into a wide-ranging elliptical orbit. The engine burn was about half an hour, and it had to work up to a minimum time to get into a basic orbit, but they wanted an even better orbit, so it had to burn even longer. Here, we followed the space show. We followed that right through all the time, and here's how the burn began, the report, just before the beginning of the burn as they approached Jupiter.
All right, Stuart, we are just about a minute away from the main engine burn. Can you explain what this is and how critical it is to the team?
Sure. We're waiting for the start of the burn. There's going to be a tone or two that we'll hear just in advance by a minute or two. We'll get a tone or two right at the start of the burn. And this will indicate that the burn is starting, a 35-minute burn that'll put us into orbit in this kind of an attitude, burning in such a way that it slows our velocity. We're moving in the down direction, and so we're going to slow ourselves so that we're not moving as fast, and that will put us into orbit. We're also noticing from our Doppler signal, which you might have seen, that we're doing exactly the things that we expected that we would do. We performed the turn, we performed the spin up, and we're seeing those signals, and the Doppler will also see that signal very clearly in the Doppler once the burn starts. So we're waiting for that as well. Right. Everything's looking good.
Standing by.
And then a few moments later, the burn began.
Systems, this is Nav.
Go ahead, Nav.
Yeah, we see the expected sharp shift upward and the Doppler residuals indicating the main engine has started.
Copy that. That's good news. We are still awaiting confirmation of that in the film.
All right, the main engine burn has started, and that will continue for another 35 minutes. And that's the time they need to put this spacecraft into a 53-day orbit. That is the orbit that they are looking for.
And then a quarter of an hour later, halfway through the burn, this is the report that we heard.
And right now we are going back to the MSA and rejoining Stuart for an update.
Hi, Gay.
Hi, Stuart.
Hey, Gay. Everything's going really well so far as we can tell. The tones that signaled the start of the burn weren't seen right away, but we did in fact record them, and we verified that we received them at our other DSN complex. So we verified with the tones that we started the burn. More than that, though, we also verified with something called Doppler, the change in the frequency of the radio signal that we're still getting. It's just the regular carrier signal that doesn't have information encoded on it. And we can tell that that signal changed at the moment of the start of the burn and changed in its slope in such a way that the change in velocity was recorded. And we could tell that we're starting to record that change in velocity as we're now slowing ourselves down as we go into Jupiter's orbit in that 35-minute burn. So we're monitoring the Doppler. We also saw the Doppler changes for the turn and for the spin-up, and we'll see more Doppler changes a little later that accompany the tones and telling us something about what's going on the spacecraft. Everything looks great so far. We're a little less than halfway through the entire 35-minute burn.
At the time of the orbit insertion, Juno was being tracked by two of the Deep Space Network stations. The prime one was at Goldstone, which is in California, out in the desert, and Tidbinbilla was the backup, Tidbinbilla in Canberra, Australia. Very soon, travelling at an enormous speed, but now beginning to slow down because of the engine firing, the Juno crossed the equator.
All right. Well, the primary goal of this mission is to improve our understanding of Jupiter's formation and evolution. The spacecraft will investigate the planet's origins, interior structure, deep atmosphere, and the magnetosphere. Juno's study of Jupiter will help us understand the history of our solar system and provide new insights into how planetary systems form and develop in our galaxy and beyond.
Gay and others, I think we're about one halfway through the 35-minute burn. We've got another halfway to go, but what that means is that we started the burn on one side of Jupiter's equator, and we're going to end it on the other side of Jupiter's equator, and we're right now roughly crossing the equator of Jupiter at the closest approach point to Jupiter. It's actually 3 degrees north of the equator, and that closest approach point, closer than no other spacecraft has ever been before, is about 2,800 miles above the cloud tops, or 4,500 kilometers, and our velocity, our speed, is 58 kilometers a second. I'll translate that for you. That's 36 miles per second, or about 130,000 miles per hour. That's the fastest we'll be going relative to Jupiter as we go right past at its closest approach point. We'll slow down a little bit as we go past that. We're continuing to slow down in general with our burn, just enough at the end of that 35-minute burn to put us into orbit about Jupiter in the right 53-and-a-half-day orbit that Gay was referring to earlier.
Now, the full engine burn was not required to actually get into orbit. As I said, the full burn was required to get into the proper orbit, but a minimum orbit could have been had on a lesser burn, and here's how the threshold of being captured into orbit was announced.
Scott Bolton, the PI from the Southwest Research Institute, joins us now. This has been your baby. How does it feel to be seeing us go through the burn like this?
It is incredibly exciting. I mean, it's going well. The rocket's burning. We're slowing down and getting into orbit around Jupiter. It's so great of a feeling.
Now, what are you watching out for as we go through this burn? Are there key moments that you're watching?
So there's a couple of milestones that I think are really critical. One of them is the burn, the 20-minute mark on the burn, which we're coming up to really quick.
We're at, 39 minutes past the hour.
We're at it, basically.
We're at it.
And so that's a critical point because although we're not in the orbit that we really desire, we probably burned enough that we're captured by Jupiter.
It's interesting. We heard the team clapping just a little while ago. So they were clapping at the fact that we are technically, it may not be the orbit that you are hoping for just yet, but we are already in orbit around Jupiter.
Right. Even if the engine stopped right now, I think we would just be in a very large orbit.
Okay.
So we've made the transition from being in orbit around the sun to being in orbit around Jupiter. At least that's the theoretical predictions, but it's right around that 20-minute mark, so we should have just crossed that. Every minute now is icing on the cake. We're getting it better and better into the closer orbit that we want, which improves the science, gets everything that we want. And then there's another critical time, about a half hour after the burn stops, where we actually have to turn the spacecraft back to the sun. That gets us power positive again. Right now we're running batteries. Right? We can't get any power because the solar rays are not pointing at the sun. We've got to point that back to the sun so that the juices start flowing through Juno's veins again. That's what gives you the electricity for the rest of the mission.
So for a solar-powered spacecraft, that's your lifeline.
That's it. That's the critical time. You got to get back on the sun. So we're not out of everything, all the risk, but the majority of the risk we've already accomplished.
And the tension continued, even though we were now in orbit. But would we be in the correct orbit? Finally, after 35 minutes of the burn, this is what we heard from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
All right, we are about 30 seconds away from the minimum burn, which was 52 minutes after the hour. And I see a display here, and the estimated orbit at this point is about 62 days, and it keeps counting down. The longer we burn, the shorter the orbital period at this point, at this stage of the burn, it's about 61 days. So we're just counting down.
All stations on June Accord, it's time we see the tone for minimum burn timer. Almost there. All stations on June Accord, we have the tone for burn cutoff on Delta B. Roger, go move, Juno. Welcome to Jupiter.
This is prop.
We're there.
Based on the from the moon, burn time was 21.02 seconds, only differing 1 second off of the pre-burn predictions.
Copy that.
Welcome to Jupiter.
At this time, we also see the tone for the come down to 2 RPM target.
And we recorded that from the live broadcast from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. That happened yesterday afternoon. Now we're going to go to the Melbourne Planetarium in a few minutes, but first, these station announcements.
The standard emergency warning signal has been adopted nationally to precede a warning of an emergency situation such as a fire, flood, or earthquake aftershock. The alert sounds like this. When you hear it, you should stop whatever you're doing. Listen very carefully to the message that follows and act as advised to protect yourself and others. When you hear this signal, listen as if your life depends on it.
You're listening to The Space Show, a program tonight about the Juno mission. Now, you might ask, well, why is the Juno mission so named? J-U-N-O. Well, if you know some mythology, you might know it. But just to help out, Tanya Hill is an astronomer at the Melbourne Planetarium in Spotswood. And on Saturday, she had this explanation of how the spacecraft got the name Juno.
So what the question was about is how the Juno mission got its name. And so the idea being that Jupiter was quite good at getting up to mischief, and what he would actually do was put a veil of clouds around himself so that his wife Juno wouldn't be able to see the mischief that he was getting up to. Well, it turns out Juno was a god as well. And so Juno was the one person that had the ability to actually peer away and see through the clouds and see what Jupiter was getting up to. And so I think that it was really lovely that then that's where they decided to name the mission Juno, because that's exactly what the Juno spacecraft is going to be doing, peering away those clouds and seeing what's going on. Another little tidbit as well that I wasn't able to add in, the mission scientists actually worked with Lego, and they produced three little Lego figures, one of the god Jupiter, one of the goddess Juno, and one of Galileo, in tribute to Galileo first identifying Jupiter as a planet, and then also to the Galileo spacecraft as well. And so those little Lego models are made of aluminium, I believe, so that they can endure the rigours of space and the launch, are actually flying on the spacecraft as well.
And that's Tanya Hill. She was speaking at the Final Frontier Festival, which was hosted by the Melbourne Space Program at the University of Melbourne on Saturday. And she gave quite a nice talk about Juno and what its objectives are. So why don't we cross over there to Melbourne University and hear Tanya's talk.
It's a pretty exciting time at the moment. We're actually, well, NASA is about to embark on a new journey of discovery in terms of understanding the planet Jupiter. So the Juno spacecraft, which you can see there, simulated against the big planet Jupiter, will actually be going into orbit around Jupiter next Tuesday, our time. So it's a very ideal time to start getting the word out about this exciting mission. It's got a number of firsts in it. One of the things being with the Juno spacecraft there, you can see it's very iconic with its three solar panels. It's our first solar-powered spacecraft to actually have ventured this far across the solar system. The other thing as well is that the spacecraft is spinning. It spins about two or three times a minute, and that helps keep it very stable. And so they can make sure that it's pointing and heading in the direction that they would like to go. Let's find out a little bit more about the mission. Well, firstly, why Jupiter? Why all of the excitement about going and seeing this gas giant in our solar system? Now, I often talk about Jupiter being the king of the planets. You've probably heard that numerous times. It is the largest planet in the solar system. But one of the things you may not be aware of is that not only is it the biggest planet in the solar system, but it's the biggest by far. In fact, if you were to take everything else orbiting the sun, so including the other gas giants, including Earth and the other rocky planets, gather up all the asteroids, gather up all the comets, everything that we know or that could exist orbiting around our sun, if you were to combine all of that together, you would still be less than half the mass of what Jupiter is. Okay, Jupiter is about 70% of all the mass of objects that is actually orbiting around. If you were to take all that mass, 70% of it sits within Jupiter. So it really is dominant in our solar system. And because of that, it was probably the first planet to have formed. And so therefore, one of the key things that Jupiter holds is some of the secrets about what the early conditions were like in the solar system, what the original gas cloud, what composition it had, what it was made out of, and also the processes that helped to form planets. And so in learning about Jupiter and how Jupiter formed, we're also learning about the early times of the solar system, and through that we can also learn a little bit more about how our own planet formed and how we came to be here. So the story of that formation, it's really the formation of the solar system is really the story, the formation of the sun. So the sun formed out of an interstellar gas cloud. It formed in the centre, and as it did, there was a debris, all the leftover material that didn't end up falling down and becoming part of the sun, ended up forming a debris disk around our star. And it's out of this debris disk that all the planets ended up forming. And as I said, Jupiter took most of that stuff. And so Jupiter's kind of the leftovers from the sun, and then we and everything else is the leftovers of the leftovers. And it also likely formed first. And being so big, it's had a lot of influence as well in how the solar system formed and what else might have gone on. So what are the key science objectives that the Juno spacecraft is hoping to discover for us? And there's four key things that it's looking for. One of them is the origin, as I mentioned, talking about how the planet formed and therefore what the early solar system was like. The other amazing thing, which I'm going to talk about quite a bit in this talk, is that Juno, even though it's not actually sending a probe or going to be entering through the atmosphere of Jupiter and actually physically going inside Jupiter, it's still doing some amazing experiments and has some incredible instruments that are going to be able to tell us for the first time what the interior of Jupiter is like. The other amazing thing is one of the things that makes Jupiter so iconic is its gorgeous atmosphere. Are we only seeing, with those beautiful bands, are we only seeing the top layers of clouds of Jupiter, or do they delve more deeply into the planet? And so it's going to look at the atmosphere and the composition and why we've got the different coloured bands that we see across Jupiter. Another big question is the Great Red Spot, the other thing that makes Jupiter so iconic. It's been there since Galileo first pointed a telescope up at the planet, and more recently we're seeing that it does appear to be shrinking quite slightly. What's going on there? And lastly, Juno's going to measure for the first time the magnetosphere around Jupiter, and this is really what makes Jupiter quite a dangerous place, actually, and it is going to be dangerous for Juno throughout the mission, and we'll talk more about that a little later as well. So first off, as I said, this little spacecraft, it's going to go into orbit around Jupiter on Tuesday. And one of the things that it's going to be able to probe is, does Jupiter have a rocky core? Now, you've probably often seen textbooks quote, we often talk about this rocky core of Jupiter, and it's part of how we think planets formed, that there were these icy, smaller objects that managed to gather together until it formed big enough that it was actually able to pull some of the cloud, some of the gas that was left over from when the sun formed, and then that created the much bigger atmosphere of Jupiter and made Jupiter grow to be what such a big planet that it is today. But we don't actually have any evidence that that rocky core, that icy core, actually exists. And Juno's going to be able to track that down, and it's doing it in quite an interesting way. What they're able to do is they're going to be tracking the path of the spacecraft, the trajectory of the spacecraft as it orbits around Jupiter. Now, this diagram here, it's very exaggerated, but pretty much what it's saying is in the purple there, you can see what the ideal orbit of Juno would be. And that's kind of how we modelled how we work out most things when it comes to physics. We just imagine that all the mass of Jupiter is actually situated right at the heart of Jupiter. And so therefore you would say that Juno would follow this beautiful, very perfect curved path as it orbits around. But of course that's not going to be the case. And different rather than have all the mass concentrated in one part, it's going to be spread out in various ways across the planet. And so just by watching tiny and really small perturbations of the Juno spacecraft as it orbits around Jupiter, that's how they're going to then be able to calculate whether which parts of Jupiter might have more mass and a higher gravitational field, and then be able to determine if it does have a rocky core. And this will inform our ideas about how planets formed. Because as I mentioned, the one main idea is that you do start with this rocky core and then that grows until you can bring in enough gas. And that's quite different to how stars form. If there isn't a rocky core around Jupiter, then maybe it is that Jupiter forms more like the way a star does. Maybe Jupiter collapsed directly out of the cloud of gas, out of the debris that remained from when the sun formed. And so that's one of the questions that Juno's hoping to answer. Now, we have had another spacecraft going to orbit around Jupiter before. It was the Galileo spacecraft. It was in orbit from 1995 through till about 2003. And it was able, when it first arrived at Jupiter in late 1995, it actually sent a probe plunging down through Jupiter's upper atmosphere to measure in situ what Jupiter was made out of. And I love, I just want to show you a graph in a moment of what it made, what it detected. But I heard Scott Bolton, who's the principal investigator of the Juno mission, talking about this Galileo probe, and said that in the 30 minutes that it plunged through the upper atmosphere, it went down to about 150 kilometres through Jupiter's atmosphere. That in that 30 minutes, it completely destroyed all the theories that had been around thinking about how Jupiter might have been formed. And so it's amazing what can happen when we get spacecraft up there to better understand. So I have included, this is the one graph that I've put in, but I think it really does tell the story about what's going on. So when the Galileo probe, as it descended down, it was measuring the different materials across in the atmosphere of Jupiter. On the left there, you can see it was measuring helium, neon, argon, krypton and xenon. They're all noble gases. They're material that, gases that don't, or elements that don't interact very readily with anything else. And so in fact, when we're measuring these for that reason, that's where we're measuring actually the pristine gases, the conditions that were around in the early solar system. Then to the right, you've got the elements of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen and sulfur. The things that we see quite as important, because that's the stuff that life is about. We want to find out, you know, was that around in the early solar system as well? So for helium and neon, the other thing I need to point out about this graph, the line going through the middle at one. What that is that that's telling us the ratio of how much we're measuring of this material compared to how much is in the sun, the abundance of the sun. So both Jupiter and the sun, mostly they're made of hydrogen and helium, I should say that. And for astronomers, anything that's not hydrogen or helium, we call a metal. Okay, just it makes it a lot simpler for us. So they're both mostly made of hydrogen and helium, but it turns out that Jupiter seems to have a little bit more of these heavy metals than what the sun does, more of the other stuff, and the stuff that, you know, things like that we're made of. Now, in terms of helium and neon, it was measured that there was less in Jupiter than what there is around the sun. And in fact, this had been predicted by theory. It was an amazing way of actually confirming that some theories were right. The idea being that helium is heavier than hydrogen. And so, in fact, the helium had sunk down and it can be found more internal to Jupiter than up in this upper atmosphere. As I said, the probe measured down to about 150 kilometres. And the helium actually brings the neon down with it. So that was exactly what they expected. What they didn't expect were the dots up there that you can see in blue. Because what they showed, that pretty much everything else, barring oxygen, we'll talk about oxygen in a minute, but everything else was much higher than the sun. There was more of these other noble gases, more carbon, more nitrogen, more sulfur than what the sun has. And this wasn't so unexpected. What was unexpected was that they all sat, they were pretty much about the same. And that was the surprise. Because how much of each of these elements you get should depend on the, whether they're around, depends on the temperature and pressure when Jupiter was forming. And it was thought that you should get a whole variation. Some of these elements would be much easier to have collapsed down, to condense down onto Jupiter, some would have been less. And the fact that they were all ended up being the same, that was what sent all the theorists back to the drawing board. Now, the idea is that you get these heavy elements on Jupiter because these gases get dissolved in water ice. And so you would expect that there should be a lot of water on Jupiter, and therefore also a lot of oxygen, the oxygen bound up in the H2O of the water. But in fact, they discovered that there was a lot less oxygen on Jupiter than what there was in the Sun. Now, at the moment, the way that that's being described is just, well, the probe only hit one part of Jupiter. It hasn't measured the water content right across the planet. So there still could be a lot of water on Jupiter. This water, the water ice, could have brought all these other volatiles, all these other elements to rest here on Jupiter. Maybe it was just that the probe ended up hitting a very dry patch, kind of, if you will, the Sahara Desert of Jupiter. And one of the things Juno's going to be able to do is that it's not just going to probe one area of Jupiter, it's going to be able to look at the entire planet as a whole and hopefully start to work out what was going on here. And so how is it going to do that? Because it's not sending, as I said, it's not sending a probe down into Jupiter at all. It's going to do this as it orbits around. And this is a kind of a, might look a little bit of a higgledy-piggledy diagram, but I think the various images will help to explain how it all works. So over there on the top right, I've got a picture of what we look like in the infrared. We glow with our temperature, our body temperature of 37 degrees Celsius. That means that we're actually emitting infrared radiation. Well, it turns out Jupiter glows as well. But Jupiter is a lot cooler than what we are. It's down to about minus 145 degrees Celsius. And so instead of glowing in the infrared light, it glows at longer wavelengths, at microwave wavelengths. So it's giving off microwave radiation, microwave energy. And so this is why then I put the image of the microwave oven, because it all comes down to how microwave ovens work. They work because water absorbs microwaves. And so they heat up your food, because if the food's got water in it, the microwaves are going to, the water's going to absorb the microwaves in your microwave oven. That'll energize the water and heat up your food. So if Jupiter is giving off microwaves, if there's water within the planet, the microwaves are going to be absorbed by that water. And so seeing how much microwave radiation is actually absorbed, is actually missing, is how the Juno spacecraft is going to learn how much water exists on the entire planet. The spacecraft is actually looking across three different bands of the microwave spectrum, six different energy wavelengths. And so that's what's there on the left. You can see going from longer microwave wavelengths, it will actually probe deeper into Jupiter. It's hoping to get down to about 600 kilometres down into the planet. And then as you get to higher, shorter wavelengths, higher frequency microwaves, then it'll only be probing sort of the top. And so by being able to compare what's going on, they're hoping to track down how much water is in the planet. It's a pretty amazing way to use the radiation of the planet itself, its thermal radiation, to actually use that to probe how much water is there. So Jupiter has these amazing coloured cloud bands, and they're always moving. And so you've got easterly facing bands, westerly moving bands. The red spot seems to be in a very stable area where we've got moving across the top going one way, moving across the bottom going the other way, keeping that stable region. How far those cloud layers? Are we just looking at the top surface of the clouds? Is this just weather conditions on Jupiter? Or does it go further down into the structure of the planet? That's something that the Juno spacecraft is going to probe. And the other thing that's really important about this mission is that it's the first time that a spacecraft will actually orbit around the poles of Jupiter. And one of the things, this is actually an image of Jupiter. I often think it looks more like an artistic, an artist's painting of it, but it is actually, it's an image from the Cassini spacecraft, which was out in orbit, which is now in orbit around Saturn. And as it passed through Jupiter, it took this image. And you can see that you've got those beautiful cloud bands, as we saw earlier, but they're situated more towards the equator of Jupiter, whereas if you go up to the poles, it's a lot more mottled. And why do you have that change? What's going on? These are all things that Juno is going to help investigate. And lastly, it's going to look at Jupiter's magnetic field, its magnetosphere. And this is what makes the mission quite exciting and a little bit dangerous as well for the spacecraft. Because Jupiter has these very strong magnetic fields. It's about 20,000 times stronger than Earth's magnetic field. It's thought to be formed because internally to Jupiter, where you've got all this hydrogen gas, hydrogen and helium is mostly what Jupiter and the Sun are made out of. It's thought that the hydrogen internally to Jupiter is under so much pressure that in fact it's become a liquid. And once you get liquid hydrogen, that means that the electrons within that liquid can move around, and so you can actually get the hydrogen to be a conductor, to be a metal. And then by the time you've got Jupiter spinning, a 10-hour spins very quickly, this sets up your dynamo, which can then drive the magnetic field. And what's really interesting about what Juno is going to do, so Juno pretty much has got an instrument on board that's like a compass, except not only is it going to be able to measure the direction of the of Jupiter's magnetic field, it's also going to be able to measure its strength. So as it passes by the planet, it'll really be able to map everywhere it goes the strength of the magnetic field and as well as its direction. The other interesting thing is that it's going to be able to measure this and probe right down onto that the surface of that dynamo to see how the magnetic field is generated. It's something that we can't actually do in terms of Earth's magnetic field, because the dynamo, the molten iron inside Earth's core, which is what is thought to establish Earth's magnetic field, it's hidden by our crust, because the Earth's crust is magnetised. And so that doesn't allow us to kind of extend down and see what's happening on the surface of the dynamo, whereas Juno is going to be able to probe that. The other thing I just want to mention, I'll come back to, but while we're looking at this lovely artistic rendition of what the magnetic field looked like, you can see that the magnetic field can trap charged particles. Brings down charged particles, and what that sets up is a radiation belt. Earth has the Van Allen radiation belts. Well, Jupiter's are much stronger, and so you can just see they're there, and they will eventually be a problem for the Juno spacecraft. So these charged particles, they get pulled down by Earth's Jupiter's magnetic field. They're mostly concentrated at the Jupiter's poles, where the magnetic field gets stronger, and they create amazing aurora. Similar process to what goes on here on Earth to create our northern and southern lights. Hubble Space Telescope is measuring the aurora around Jupiter, and it'll be doing that for almost daily for the next few months, so that it can track what's happening, how the aurora appear, and it's seems to be that the aurora is quite energetic and excited at this time, which bodes well for the fact that the Juno spacecraft is almost about there. So we're going to get UV images from Hubble while the Juno spacecraft is actually flying over the poles of Jupiter and actually measuring the particles that are causing this excitation and causing these aurora. The other neat thing, on Earth, the aurora is all due to particles from the Sun. Whereas with Jupiter, you also have particles streaming in from Jupiter's large moons, the Galilean satellites. And so you can see there, I've just done a zoom up of an aurora around Jupiter. And you can see these little what are called footprints that are coming in from the moon of Io and Ganymede and Europa. So you kind of have this connection. The magnetic field of Jupiter actually reaches out and connects Jupiter with its moons, drawing off particles that are escaping from the moons and then being drawn down onto Jupiter. So It is going to be quite an amazing mission. As I said, a spacecraft that will remain in orbit around the planet, but is actually going to help us probe the internal structure of the gas giant. Does it have a dense core? Is that how planets form? What's going on with this liquid metallic hydrogen? Is that how the dynamo is created? Is that how the magnetic field is created around Jupiter? And then measuring down that first 600 kilometres of Jupiter's atmosphere, is there water there? Is water how material was brought down? Those other gases other than hydrogen and helium, is water the way that it's brought onto Jupiter, or do we have to rethink all our theories completely? So a little bit about the spacecraft itself to finish up. How did we get here? Well, this Juno was launched back in August 2011. Now, it only had enough rocket fuel to make it out beyond the orbit of Mars. And then in 2012, it actually fired its rocket to send it coasting right back to Earth. And of course, the reason for this was that it used an Earth flyby, a gravity assist, to then give it the boost needed to send it on its way out to Jupiter. And so it's been in cruising mode for the last 3 years. And then you may well hear a lot about the 4th of July. It's quite interesting. Again, I heard one of the NASA scientists talking about it. Normally, NASA scientists work in universal time, which is different to local time in the US. But when they realised that if, in fact, they worked in local US time, it would make it the 4th of July, whereas if they were in universal time, it would be the early hours of the 5th. They decided for this mission that they would go with the local US time, because that helped them to, you know, 4th of July being Independence Day for the US. So for our time, it'll be at around 1:18 p.m. on the 5th of July. And that's when it'll start an engine burn of about 35 minutes, which should slow the spacecraft down enough so that it's able to be captured by Jupiter's gravity. And then when it does this, it's on a quite highly elliptical orbit. And so it's going to be incredibly close to the planet, just about 5,000 kilometres above the surface. And then it'll venture out almost as far as the orbit of Callisto, one of Jupiter's moons, and then it'll come plunging back in again. So all the serious science, all the work is going to be done on those close encounters with Jupiter. That'll be about 6 hours that all the science, all the excitement will be happening. And then it takes about 10, 12 days for then the spacecraft to continue on its elliptical orbit and then come back through again. So in some ways, you could, rather than thinking of this spacecraft orbiting around Jupiter, it's more like it's doing a series of flybys. And over the next 18 months or so, it's planned to do 33 to 37 orbits or flybys of Jupiter. Now, over time, those orbits are going to drift. When Juno first gets there, the spacecraft is actually going to be almost able to skim between Jupiter and where the radiation belt starts. But by the end of the mission, it's going to be travelling more and more through these radiation belts. And they consist of charged particles, and charged particles are not good. They're radiation. They're not good for your electronics. So they have enclosed all the instruments or the computers on Juno in a titanium vault. But even so, it's thought that after about 18 months or so, there'll be enough degradation that they're going to have to do something while they still have control of the spacecraft. Because one of the worries is that you don't want the spacecraft to grow out of control and end up possibly colliding with one of Jupiter's moons or another object around Jupiter and possibly contaminating those worlds with some sort of bacteria or something from Earth. So they have planned that this mission will end in 18 to 20 months and Juno will be plunged into the atmosphere of Jupiter. It's not going to be, you know, so many of NASA's missions now are so highly successful and they just keep going and going. The Mars rovers are some of that, because the Cassini spacecraft has recently been extended again. It's been around Saturn for, I think, a decade now. Whereas this is one where there is a limited time period for them to be able to do their science. So It's all pretty much happening in the next week or so. We've got our fingers crossed for all the scientists and the engineers, hoping that everything goes to plan. This is the only instrument with Juno Cam. And it's the only instrument on board Juno that can actually take coloured photos, optical photos. And in fact, it's there. It's part of Juno's public outreach. And so you can search for Juno Cam, and they're actually wanting, because they can't use the camera to view every single part of Jupiter, what they've actually asked is for amateur astronomers to take photos of Jupiter and to highlight the regions that they would most like Juno Cam to take a look at, particularly around the poles of Juno, because we've never seen the poles before. And then they've opened up the whole scientific process of how a mission is undertaken, in that they're hoping that amateur astronomers, and they actually have been uploading images onto the Juno Cam website, and then they're inviting the amateurs, the community and the public to vote on which are the best images, and to put forward scientific reasons of why you might want to look at those. And then when they gather the data, they're actually going to put the raw data there for the public to be able to work with and play with and analyse and see what they can produce. And so it really is a chance for everybody to become part of this mission. So it's a pretty amazing feat that they're trying to do. They certainly haven't shied away from any of the hard parts of understanding what's going on at Jupiter, but hopefully it will start to unlock some of the keys about how the solar system, the early times of the solar system, and how planet formation. And in some ways, this isn't just talking about how our own solar system formed, but of course now we also know that there are thousands of planets orbiting around other stars out there, what we call exoplanets. Many of these that were found are of a Jupiter class. And so this mission may well also give insights into how those hot Jupiters as well formed around other stars out there in our galaxy. And lastly, just to finish up, I wanted to the Juno website has an amazing amount of material on it. And these are just some of the engineers and scientists that have been working on the mission. And I think it's always important to remember how much goes into this. And I really do recommend that you have a look at the site, because one of the videos that they have is talking about how each of these scientists actually got involved and got interested in space, and what was it that drove them to now end up being working on the Juno mission. And it's quite inspiring to hear about their journeys and what they're doing. And you know, fingers crossed that all goes well for them in the next few days. So thank you very much.
And that was Tanya Hill, an astronomer at the Melbourne Planetarium, which is part of the Science Works Museum in Spotswood. And if you haven't been to the planetarium, why don't you pop along there over to Spotswood and have a look at it? It's actually fantastic, some of the shows that she does there. We recorded that talk at the Final Frontier Festival, which was hosted by the Melbourne Space Program at the University of Melbourne at the weekend. And that's something you might want to look up as well, the Melbourne Space Program, which is not a radio program. It's actually a coordination of all sorts of space type efforts. More about Juno after these messages.
Can you imagine having to learn to walk or talk again at your age? Recovering after a stroke is a long journey. It's often very confusing and quite lonely. But there's lots of people who've been there before and are wanting to help. EnableMe is Australia's online stroke community. It's full of resources and videos, tools to guide recovery or share personal stories. You can even ask a question of a stroke health professional. It's for stroke survivors, their family and friends. And it's free from the Stroke Foundation. Visit enableme.org.au.
Coming up at 8 o'clock here on 88.3 Southern FM is Purple Haze, which this evening is presented by Mark Norman. And he's got a special guest, Ken Murdoch, from the legendary Oz band called Taste. And they've got a new CD, and they're in the next studio there taking selfies of themselves at the moment. Well, we're going to play out till 8 o'clock now by going back to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and some of the comments made after the orbital insertion. Here we go. Juno has arrived at Jupiter.
What a feeling. A mission of this complexity to accomplish tonight is just truly amazing. Again, very happy that you could share this moment with us. Let me turn this over now to Diane Brown.
Thank you, Jeff. I was asked to talk about what it feels like to have this success, and it's just, I mean, it's overwhelming. The team, the amount of time and effort everyone put into this, and the risks that were overcome, it's amazing. I mean, the more you know about the mission, you know just how tricky this was, and to have it be flawless. I mean, I really can't put it into words. You imagine what it might feel like, but to actually have it, to know that we can all go to bed tonight, not worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow, it's pretty awesome. So that's really all I can say. It's just amazing. So, Scott, how do you feel?
NASA did it again. That says it all to me. And I am so happy to be part of the team that did that. I mean, this team has worked so hard, and we have just such great people. And it's just it's almost like a dream coming true right here. And, you know, I had to go back and get my family and drive them in here this earlier this evening. And they get in the car and they've lived this. I mean, my kids are, you know, 12 and 13, and their whole life has been Juno, basically. And I'm driving in, and I said, so that's it. I just want you guys to remember there's some risk here tonight, you know. I said, by the time we're driving back to the hotel tonight, either we're going to be in orbit or we won't. And we're in. And now the fun begins. The science. So let me turn it over to Rick, tell you more about what happened tonight.
In a minute, but first we have to take care of some business. So we prepared a contingency communications procedure, and guess what? We don't need that anymore. History. So tonight, through tones, Juno sang to us, and it was a song of perfection. Do you realize that after a $1.7 billion journey, billion mile, they're going to kill me. After a 1.7 billion mile journey, we hit our burn targets within 1 second on a target that was just tens of kilometers large. Isn't that incredible? That's how good our team is. And that's how well the Juno spacecraft performed tonight. You see a handful of people up here, but what we represent is a team of almost 900 people that built and launched Juno, and roughly 300 people that operated it and got us all the way through into Jupiter orbit tonight.
And you've been listening to The Space Show, all about Juno. But right now, it's over to Mark Norman and Purple Haze.